One of the downsides of electronic health records.
Complementary treatments for pain.
Managing traumatic brain injury.
And using cord blood to treat people with blood cell cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on September 9th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And what a pleasure recording in person today. It's so exciting.
It's good to have you in El Paso, Elizabeth, and record face-to-face with you.
Really a blast being here. So let us turn then to the studies. I think one that's garnered a tremendous amount of media attention, and it's this ongoing issue of great concern to everyone. In Mayo Clinic Proceedings, a look at potential management strategies for chronic pain.
Elizabeth, when we talk about chronic pain, we're talking about a condition that affects over 126 million adults in the United States, at least 40 million of which have severe pain. We know that there are a number of pharmacologic agents or medications it can use, but we know that opioid use has been a real problem. So if we can get some benefit from what I'm going to call complementary health approaches or complementary medicine, that would be terrific. Well, what these investigators did was they looked at all the randomized controlled trials of complementary health techniques in U.S. population to see whether they could treat chronic pain conditions. We're talking about osteoarthritis of the knee, neck pain and back pain, and headaches and migraines. And they did a very good job of summarizing these. And again, these are all randomized controlled trials. And here's what they found, and I'm just going to summarize. For people that have back pain, it looks like acupuncture and yoga may be beneficial. For people that have osteoarthritis of the knee, acupuncture and Tai Chi may be beneficial. For neck pain, massage therapy and randomized controlled trials, at least for the short-term benefit. And for people that have severe headaches and migraine, relaxation techniques have been beneficial. There's weaker evidence for some of the other complementary health techniques in these particular disorders. Now, the nice thing is, in no case did any of the randomized controlled trials identify any serious adverse effects with any of these complementary techniques.
That's really good news, of course. Here's my question. How is it that we're going to pay for these things?
Well, these things are much less expensive than some of the pharmacologic agents we use. Now, many of these don't cost very much. For example, Tai Chi doesn't really cost a lot. Yoga doesn't cost very much. Massage therapy, fairly inexpensive as well.
Well, I guess what I'm referring to is we need some kind of transition with regard to insurance payments for these therapies.
That's, I think, going to be a hard sell. These studies were fairly small. They were randomized controlled trials, but in a fairly small number of individuals. Oftentimes, don't have the same robustness as some of the drug or medications that we use. In addition, there's a great potential for abuse as well. For a person to be involved with yoga or any of these other techniques and say, I'm going to charge insurance for it when it's not being used for chronic pain.
Well, at least I welcome an examination of alternatives to opioids because this is certainly something we need to get our arms around.
There's no question about it. Opioid use was an attempt to decrease pain, and what we've discovered is it was a pretty poor choice in the long run. These complementary medical techniques, no adverse side effects.
No doubt we'll be hearing more. Let's turn now to the New England Journal of Medicine, a couple studies we'd like to highlight this week. One taking a look at the technique craniotomy for people who have brain injury.
When people have traumatic brain injury, one of the complications is they get an increase in the pressure in the brain or an increase in what's called intracranial hypertension, and that can further the damage to the brain. Now, the real question is this best treated with medications to try to lower that pressure or by doing a craniotomy, that is removing a portion of the skull to try to release the pressure? This was a randomized trial of over 400 patients that had traumatic brain injury. They were between the ages of 10 and 65. And it was refractory, and they were randomized to either receive a craniotomy or continued medical therapy. And they were followed to see how they did at 6 months. What was discovered is that although the decompressive craniotomy resulted in lower mortality, it had a higher rate of leaving people in vegetative states and having severe disability.
It's a little sobering, isn't it? Because the folks who have traumatic brain injury, often abbreviated TBI, often have sequela of their injury almost regardless.
Right. And so what we said is we've saved more people, but we've left more people in the vegetative state or with severe disability.
I guess it's a good thing we took a look at this. This is yet one more of those things where a priori we would have assumed that it would be good to be able to lower that pressure inside the skull.
Absolutely, and that's why we do randomized trials to test two different therapies.
The other thing, of course, in the New England Journal of Medicine, something with a bit more of an upside, the use of cord blood.
I chose this particular article because people that have leukemia and other type of blood cell cancers receive chemotherapy, but that is oftentimes followed by some sort of a stem cell transplant, and that is you try to repopulate their bone marrow with normal non-cancerous cells. If you have a sibling that has this very compatible blood, then that's obviously your first choice, but that only happens in about 30% of patients that have blood cell cancers. The other 70% either look for a match that's not related to them or a mismatch. And that is, they don't match exactly, but they're closely matched. And the results are obviously not quite as good. Well, we now have cord blood. Cord blood doesn't have many of the same immune properties as mature blood cells. So this retrospective study conducted out of Seattle looked at individuals that had cancer. They were treated and had minimal residual disease, and they received either matched cells from an unrelated individual or closely matched or cord blood. And what they discovered is that the patients that had cord blood did better than those that weren't perfectly matched, and they had a lower chance of relapse, so a better survival. In fact, they looked just as good as those individuals that got a perfect match.
This is really good news, of course, because, gosh, we're just storing this stuff all over the place. So it certainly suggests another use for it.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, we have a lot more cord blood available than we do bone marrow or peripheral blood from these mismatched individuals. So the only way to prove that cord blood is as good or better is to do a randomized trial.
I guess I would also add that to me, this is somewhat tantalizing as a nerd and for all the rest of the nerds among us, because it suggests to me that there's something about the development of receptors on the surfaces of all these blood cells that's different in these circumstances.
Absolutely. Cord blood has different immune properties on the cells than very mature bloods. And so this may open the door for other treatments with cord blood from unrelated donors.
Fascinating. Finally, let's turn to something that is very interesting to me, because at Johns Hopkins, we just rolled out Epic recently, and we've got all these hopes that are attendant on the electronic health record. This study in Annals of Internal Medicine suggests that there's rather a robust downside to the electronic health record.
As you suggest, there's been an increasing pressure on physicians, especially those in the ambulatory setting, to use an electronic medical record. And you mentioned one of those called Epic. We also know that over 50% of physicians have burnout, and that burnout is tied to dissatisfaction with spending less time with patients and more time doing busy work. Well, how do you quantitate that? And that's what this study did. They looked at 57 physicians in the U.S. who were in family medicine or internal medicine or cardiology and orthopedics, and they observed them for over 430 hours, so direct observation, and also had motion detectors on these individuals. And here's what they found. During the office day, for every hour that the physicians provided direct clinical face time to the patients, they spent nearly 2 additional hours spent on the electronic medical record and desk work within that same clinic day. And in fact, outside the usual office hours, the physicians spent another 1 to 2 hours of personal time each night doing additional computer and clerical work.
That is an awful lot of time in an already compressed schedule. Tell me what your thoughts are about that.
For those of us that have been dealing with electronic medical records for many years, this is not terribly surprising to us. And I can tell you, it is a big dissatisfier. In fact, the study also showed that it's when physicians are spending face time with patients, almost 40% of the time is not looking at the patient, it's looking at the computer. So that's a dissatisfier not only for the physician, but for the patient as well.
Okay, so then let us speculate on potential solutions, because this is not something that's going to go away. At least I don't think it's going to.
No. In fact, the American College of Physicians has put together a program called Patients Before Paperwork to try to help physicians to reduce the administrative burden. There are several tools. One can use scribes, for example. One can delegate to other ancillary or auxiliary healthcare professionals. We also need to make the electronic record more friendly to physicians as well. So there's a lot of work to do. But if we don't fix this, again, this is a huge dissatisfier and a big reason for physician burnout and why they're retiring early.
I guess one of the things I have a lot of hope for in not just this venue, but in other venues, is voice recognition software that would be able to allow the physician to simply speak the note rather than have to go through all the typing and all of that.
And there is some of that available, and it can make things more efficient. But at the end, you still have to go back and correct it, by the way. So it still takes an inordinate amount of time. Physicians want to spend time with patients. They don't want to spend time doing busy work. So This is, I think, an incredibly important study, and I hope that the physicians that are listening will rally around it and help drive the electronic medical record to be more user-friendly and more efficient.
Excellent. On that note, I think I'm going to write about the complementary pain techniques this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.